Let's open this morning with prayer then. Lord God, Heavenly Father, we come before you with joy this morning, thanking you that we have this opportunity to gather for fellowship and knowledge. We pray that you would bless our discussions together, and also that you would bless each of us in our daily lives. We also thank you for the fantastic gift of your Son, who died that we may have forgiveness of sins and new life. Be with us in this new year, fill us with your Spirit, and grant us your peace. Amen. This morning I would like to share with you some verses from Philippians chapters 2 and 4. I'm sure you'll find them easy to understand, but I think they have much to say to each of us, and I would like to offer a few thoughts for us to consider. If our life in Christ means anything to you, if love can persuade at all, or the spirit that we have in common, or any tenderness and sympathy, then be united in your convictions and united in your love, with a common purpose and a common mind. What a fantastic blessing it is to be able to have this unity of purpose and mind, and to desire to be one in the Spirit. It's only when we begin to realize the full impact of Christ's action in our lives that, motivated by his love, we can begin to serve him and each other. There must be no room for rivalry and personal vanity among you, but be humble toward each other, never thinking you are better than others, so that nobody thinks of his own interests first, but everybody thinks of other people's interests instead. In your minds, you must be the same as Christ Jesus. So often our lives are self-centered. Rather, they should always be Christ-centered. It is only when all that we do or say or think is to the glory of God that we can truly be as Christ Jesus and want to put others first. None of us know what the future holds for us, but we do know that we will always be in contact with other people, whether it's people in a congregation, people at work or in the family, or even other pastors' wives. It is then that I think it will be good for us to remember these words of Paul and to always act out of love. Do everything without complaining or arguing, that you may be innocent and pure, as God's perfect children who live in a world of crooked and mean people. You must shine among them like stars, lighting up the sky as you offer them the message of life. How hard it is to remember this, never to complain or argue. We so often feel that it's our right to express our feelings. Then St. Paul reminds us to take care. We have a responsibility to those around us who need to hear the good news. It is by God's working in us and through us that others may come to believe in that good news. And finally, may you always be joyful in your life in the Lord. I say it again, rejoice. Show a gentle attitude toward all. The Lord is coming soon. There's no need to worry, but if there's anything you need, pray for it, asking God for it with prayer and thanksgiving. And that peace of God, which is so much greater than we can understand, will guard your hearts and your thoughts in Christ Jesus. As humans, I think we often tend to seek happiness and personal contentment in the activities and people of our daily lives. But real happiness is to be found in the simple, assuring knowledge of the presence of Christ Jesus in our midst. Just knowing Christ as our personal Lord and Savior should make us rejoice and fill us with that peace that passeth all understanding. And so it is that through Christ's love, we can each experience the joy of a life lived to its fullest, and we'll be able to rejoice in our relationships with others that have more meaning as we strive to be as Christ Jesus, remembering to be humble and to put others first. Our tasks may be large and our burdens heavy at times, But St. Paul would encourage us in one of the last verses of Philippians, "There's nothing I can master, there's nothing I cannot master with the help of the one who gives the strength."
Thank you, Debbie, for your very inspirational words. First, I want to welcome all of you and thank you for coming out. This workshop is going to be very formative to all of us, I'm sure. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to have each member of our panel give an introduction to each topic, and then we will have discussion from the panel if they wish to embellish anything the first person said. And then we will have questions from you to the panel. Now I'd like to introduce our panel. We will begin at my far right, your left. We have Mrs. Lawrence Bergdorf, Sue. She and her husband are out at Our Redeemer in Overland. They have been in the ministry for 20 years. They have served in Ohio, Texas, and now they're in Missouri. And they have three children, and she is a second grade teacher at Overland Park Lutheran School. Next we have Mrs. Edwin Weber, Vera. Her husband is the first vice president of our synod. He has been in the ministry for 42 years, and she has been with him for 40 of those 42 years. He has served in Illinois the first 2 years, and then together they have served in Michigan. Her husband has served as vice president and president of the Michigan district. He has been in synodical offices since 1969, and they have moved to St. Louis in 1973. And Mrs. Weber is a very good friend of the seminary. She is the president of the Seminary Guild. Next, we have Mrs. Edwin DeBerkey, Joanne. Her husband is at Ascension. They have been in the ministry 20 years. They have served in Wisconsin and Missouri. She has three teenagers, and she is the kindergarten teacher at Word of Life School. Next, we have Mrs. Paul Spitz, Yvonne. They are at Timothy Lutheran Church. They have been in the ministry for 30 years. They began their ministry in Wyoming in a mission congregation, which is about 120 miles from Yellowstone National Park. Then they went to Nebraska and served in Seward in a town gown situation, which is you serve a congregation plus a campus ministry. And now they are here in Missouri. Pastor Spitz was mission director of the Western District and later the Missouri District. They have three children, and Mrs. Spitz is Pastor Spitz's right-hand lady. Next, we have Mrs. William Friedrichs, Doris. They are at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, De Pere, West County. They have been in the ministry for 28 years. They have served in Montana, Oklahoma, and Missouri. They also had a town gown situation in Rolla, Missouri. They have four children. One of them is with us this morning. Sue Glusenkamp is Mrs. Friedrich's daughter. And she is a secretary in the personnel office at Penny's at West County. And the next person we know, this is Mrs. Paula Theiss, and this is Lita. And we included her because she has had a 2-year vicarage, and many of us are going to be vicars' wives, and we thought it very appropriate to include a vicar, you know, vicar's wife on our staff. And last we have Mrs. David Wollenberg, Jerry, and they have been in the preaching ministry for 6 years, and Jerry was a school teacher for 4, and they have served in Michigan, Illinois, and he is now admissions counselor here at the seminary. Now we will begin. Our first topic is their house, our home, and we'll have Mrs. Bergdorf begin for us.
Can you hear me? Is this okay? Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to tell you that I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity to be here today. Being on this panel and having these topics to look over has given me an opportunity to think back over a lot of the experiences that I've had since we've been in the ministry, and most of them are very happy and delightful experiences. So this has really been a good experience for me. Much of what I'm going to tell you will be my own personal ideas about this, so I hope you'll keep that in mind. I'm sure if one of the other members of the panel had spoken to you about homes and houses, why they would have shared some other ideas with you. Years ago, my daughter had a storybook. The name of it was Madeline and the Gypsies, and if you have a daughter, maybe you have this book in your home too. And we used to read this book over and over again because it was a favorite one. And there was one section in it, it was written in rhyme, and there's one section in it that I have remembered even till today. It said, "Gypsies do not come to stay, they only come to go away." And I used to read that and I used to think, well, that's not just gypsies, that's also pastors and their families. Because we did a lot of moving the first few years that my husband was in the ministry. The first 6 years, we moved 7 times. So it seemed like we were always either getting settled or getting ready to move. In the 20 years, though, it slowed down a little bit. We haven't moved that often in the last part of his ministry. But we've lived in a big variety of parsonages. We lived in an apartment in a 150-year-old house that was infested with rats. We lived in a parsonage that was next to the church. We lived in a church-owned parsonage that was several miles from the church. And today we live in a home which we own ourselves. And I'll have to tell you, I think we live in absolute luxury, really. We have a very nice home. We have a tennis court in our backyard. So I am very grateful that God has blessed us in this way. We have lived here now 6 years, which is the longest that we have lived any place that we have been. I'd like to briefly comment on some of the questions that were included in the material that was given to us before today. The first question was, is privacy a possibility in the parsonage? Why not? To be honest, I have to say that this has never been anything of a problem or a trouble to me. I am sure that for some people it probably is a problem. There are probably some people who would disagree with me on this. But generally, people have been very, very kind and considerate. And in looking back through our experiences in living in a parsonage, I truly cannot think of one time when I can say somebody has inconsiderately and without a good reason really invaded our privacy. I asked my husband if he could think of any times, and he could not either. Probably the most important factor here is your attitude. How do you feel about it if someone knocks at the door when you're sitting down to dinner? Or how do you feel about it when somebody calls 3 or 4 times during the night and you get out of bed to answer the phone for the 5th time and it's something that really could have waited until tomorrow? It's a real plus if you can look on these things not as intrusions, but as real opportunities to serve God's people and to show love and hospitality. And it probably goes without saying that your children are very, very quick to pick up your attitude on this kind of thing. In a lot of ways, I'm a person who really treasures privacy. I really love a very quiet time for reading or study, and I really enjoy the quiet times in the evenings when I'm with my family. Maybe we're sitting in front of the fireplace on a snowy evening. And I've always been able to find some time for this quiet and peaceful time in our lives. So I think it's very possible to have privacy in a parsonage. Another question that was included, what about churches that have always had their ladies' meetings in the parsonage living room? Well, frankly, I doubt that there are too many around anymore that really do that regularly. I think you're probably most likely to encounter this if you serve in a mission congregation where there is no church building. We served in one parish where all of the meetings were held in our apartment. This included confirmation classes, youth groups, ladies' aid, committee meetings. And it got a little busy sometimes, but it was necessary, and it was also temporary, because after a couple of years we had a church building, and then most of these meetings moved to another place. But I really feel that if it's whether it's due to necessity or whether it's due to just a tradition in the parish, extend a warm Christian welcome. It's really fun. It's not so bad. And it's certainly a very good way to get to know the people in your congregation in a way that you don't get to if you just see them on Sunday mornings. There was a request for suggestions for dealing with the parsonage committee. Again, I have to say personally because I'm going on my own experiences. I've never found a parsonage committee that really didn't have the best interests of the parsonage family at heart. I have encountered a few who did not know what their job was or who didn't really not know how to go about doing their job. So I think that it's important when there's really something that is of major importance that needs to be taken care of and no one seems to notice it, that you don't be shy. In a diplomatic way, you speak up and you mention it to the committee. But at the same time, I feel very, very strongly that you must treat a parsonage that's owned by a congregation as your own home. And you must make it yours. And that includes taking care of a lot of the minor maintenance problems on your own without calling in somebody from outside. And do as much of the work as you would do if you owned the home yourself. If a room needs to be painted, you probably need to ask or say, hey, can I paint the kids' room pink or something? But if you're a good painter, or even if you're just a so-so painter, do the painting yourself. Don't expect them to come in and do it for you. And I think if you show this kind of care and this kind of interest in it, that they'll just really cooperate with you and work with you, and you won't ever have any problems with anything like that. The other thing that was listed on the suggestion sheet was pros and cons of purchasing a home. Well, for me, you'll hear mostly the pros because I'm a very pro person on this. We've owned two homes in two different cities, and it's just worked out beautifully for us both times. There's a definite trend in that direction. Most congregations and mission boards not only will allow a pastor to own a home, but will encourage him to, and will expect him to make his own housing arrangements. In many cases, they give a housing allowance so that the pastor can either rent or purchase a home, whichever suits his needs best. Since we do live in an inflationary economy, I don't think there's much doubt or much question but what it's financially beneficial to own your own home. And we could go into that further, but I think most of you probably realize that if you rent a home, you have no real investment, and you lose the value, your investment that you might have in your own home, the appreciation that you would have if you owned your own home. The cons on this might be a reluctance to leave a home that you own, or difficulty in selling it quickly if you do decide to move. Neither of these things were a problem to us. When we had to sell our home, we advertised it ourselves, and we sold it the first week it was advertised. So I think God kind of has a part in this too. He helped us out and worked things out for us. Another problem might be the fact that you do need a down payment for most home purchases. Of course, there's FHA and VA, but again, I think there are ways to work this out, although I'm sure some of you, when you're first leaving the seminary, might think that it's pretty difficult to get together enough money for a down payment. But many churches do provide interest-free loans to called workers so that you can have some help in this way. And the church where my husband serves now provides this for all of the called workers in the church. One last thing I'd like to say, and it's really just two words, be flexible. It really doesn't make that much difference what kind of a house you live in. I think it was included here as a topic probably because we sometimes think it makes a pretty big difference. But looking back, I think some of the richest times and the times when we did the most growing in our Christian lives were the times when we had the most inadequate housing and the most severe financial problems. So these are really good times, even though at the time they might be kind of a struggle. What I really want to say, I guess, that the house is not really important. It's the home that's important. And, of course, the house can be anything, anywhere, but the home is what you and your family make it with God's help. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any additions from our panel that you would like to supplement Mrs. Bergdorf's comments? All right, do we have any questions from our audience? It must have been very thorough. No questions? All right, then we'll continue. We'll go on to our next topic. It's called The Minister and the Ministry, and Mrs. Vera Weber will.
Good morning to all of you. I certainly wish that I could meet each one of you personally. I sort of envy you. You girls are really starting out on a wonderful career as a pastor's wife, and you have something wonderful to look forward to. As Mrs. Bergdorf said, she moved around 7 times in 6 years. I lived in the same parsonage for 29 years. So I don't have those experiences, but it was great. It was a 12-room parsonage, and now I thoroughly enjoy my 4-room apartment. The topic that's been assigned to me is the minister and the ministry. This is a vast and interesting topic for many reasons. First of all, it is the greatest calling on earth because it means representing God to his people on the basis of scriptures. And second, it is the tremendous consequences because it means so much to those whose lives the minister touches. It calls for great dedication on the part of the minister and calls for the best of the talents that this man possesses. It means that day after day and year after year, the minister will perform at maximum efficiency because the cause is so great and the results of his work so vital to so many people. The minister is to be not only in his own parish, but also in the community in which he labors, a representative of his congregation before the public, because the surrounding area judges the church many times, largely by the minister at the head of it. This man labors day and night for his Lord and among his parishioners to bring them the message of salvation and to apply the word of God to all situations that they might encounter. In joy and in sorrow, he supports them and becomes their leader and their father confessor. I could go on expanding on these themes, but I am going to talk about the wife of this paragon of virtue. She lives in the same glass house and participates in the weal and woe of her husband's life and work. During my years in the parochial school, I was privileged to have my father as my teacher for 4 years. And the hours spent in catechism and Bible study were some of the most interesting. But he always stressed and encouraged mission work, going out and doing mission work. But how was I going to go out and do something like this by myself? I couldn't do it alone, so the next thought, well, maybe I can help someone someday. And the Lord works in mysterious ways, and when the time came that I was to fulfill some of these ambitions, I was going to be a pastor's wife. However, I wasn't fully aware of my responsibilities until my first Sunday in our first parish in northern Michigan. We weren't married when my husband was in Steelville, Illinois, nor were we married when he was on campus. It wasn't allowed, not even to be engaged. And when he was in Illinois, they had no parsonage for him to live in, not even a place to rent, just one room for him to live in. So we had to wait. and that's why he's in the ministry 42 years and I'm only there 40. But on the first Sunday that I attended church in our first parish in northern Michigan, a dear little old grandmother came up to me and she said, "Guten Morgen, Frau Pastor." Good morning, Mrs. Pastor. This really shocked me and made me stop and think and ask God for his help and guidance. If people were going to respect me with such a greeting, then I must be worthy of such respect. Over the years, there have been days of rejoicing and also trying days for both of us. There have been many hours spent alone for me while my husband was out attending a meeting, making sick calls, a late call at the hospital, or sitting with troubled parishioners. This is going to happen to you too. You're going to spend many quiet hours all by yourself, and I think sometimes we do need them. Your husband may not be in a position to give you all of the details after some of these sessions, and it's best not to prod him. Your husband too will share with you some of the interesting happenings in his day, and you will be a good sounding board for on many occasions when he comes home and tells you about these things. You will always be his biggest supporter. If you don't support him, then it's pretty sad. You're going to be consulted by him from time to time as he counsels people of all ages. He may need to know some of the things that you have heard among the parishioners. And counseling is a never-ending task in the ministry. I think it's becoming more so all the time. It didn't seem to be that way when we first got into the ministry, but counseling is really a big job now. You're not always going to hear the latest news from him either. You're going to have somebody come up to you and say, ask you if you know about something, and you can say, "No, I don't know." And, "Well, your husband knows all about it. We told him." But this is good because they know that he is not betraying their confidences. And it's better for you to hear it from someone else than to hear it from your husband. And your husband is going to have to tell you that he's not at a liberty to tell you everything that has been told to him either. And don't feel insulted because there is a part of him that just doesn't belong to you. It belongs to all of his parishioners. Members are going to seek your good counsel, and when this happens, be sure that you do not overstep your bounds. I was called on the phone one time even to find this lady wanted to know if her child had chickenpox or measles, and she described the whole thing to me, and I said, "Well, I'm no doctor, and I'm not going to give out this kind of information, but why don't you go see your doctor?" And so that was about one of the worst things I could think of, but there are other things that people ask you about. And sometimes it is good just to be a good listener and let them pour out their problems. You're going to be thanked profusely for being so helpful, and actually all you've done is listen. You haven't uttered a word, but just to be able to talk to someone and they know, they have the confidence in you that what they tell you is not going to go on out of the parsonage. Let it stop here too. And much of what you hear is told in confidence, and we just don't betray the confidences of our people. There are those who are going to pry and prod for bits of information. They just seem to think that you know it all, and when your husband becomes a pastor, then they figure right away you know all the answers that he knows, too. This doesn't rub off like that. We sort of have to work our way through this. But when they come and ask you, and you can detect that there's going to be some gossip connected with this, just politely say, "I don't know, and I can't very well tell a lie. They always know I know, but I'm not about to give them the information." They'll soon learn that you are not going to pass on any information that doesn't need to be spread out among the people. Much of the pastor's time is spent in teaching, and you're familiar with all the various classes that and the hours that they consume, Bible classes, Sunday school teachers meetings, and just ladies groups, men's groups, just everything, evangelism and board meetings, and they're expected to attend most of these. And you can assist here too. We can do our part as pastors' wives, and no parish ever has an overabundance of willing workers and Sunday school teachers. I taught Sunday school for 24 years, and it was the most wonderful experience for me. Should have taught another one. I just didn't add my years up in time before I quit. We are not being above being an active layperson in the parish. Much is expected of our lay people. We expect them to come and participate in everything, and we expect them to be active and give of their time as well as their talents. And here, too, we can be good examples by teaching Sunday school, singing in the choir, belonging to different societies and LWML, I always stress that, and evangelism groups. I realize there are children, there are small children for many of you, and there are home responsibilities. I had children, too, and it always seemed to work out well, and especially after they're able to take care of themselves, this is really great. Then you can just blossom. You may never know how many lives are influenced by the things that you do and by your participation in many of these societies and the example that you set to all of your people. And much is said of protocol in high places. This carries down into our levels also. You are the first lady of your parish, and you are respected and loved by your parishioners, more so than you think. And let them love you and let them treat you like they really want to. They want to do things for you and your family and enjoy it. It's great. You are the hostess for many of the church functions. This is sort of automatic, and sometimes someone will ask you to do it. Do it because it gives you an opportunity to meet many people, and especially when you have guest speakers in your parish. And I speak here from experience. My husband has been a guest speaker so often, and I've been able to accompany him good many a time. But I have been at places already where I stand around and I look and I don't see the pastor's wife, and people will walk by and they say, oh, hello. They don't say, are you a stranger here or anything. And after a while, after everybody's gone, and the pastor will come and say, oh, didn't my wife look you up? And no, I've been sitting here alone or something. We're not queers. We're not aloof. We just would like to meet all of the people that are serving the Lord in the same capacity and just be friendly and be a good hostess. It will be appreciated. A wife can make or break a man in any walk of life. And executives in the business world are interviewed, and many times the wife is also considered in this particular office for which her husband might be considered. This doesn't happen in the ministry. Your husband receives his call by divine guidance, and he will consider it in such a way also. From personal experience, I can tell you, though, that the district president has an evaluation sheet of every pastor in his district, and the wife of the pastor has a little line in that evaluation sheet also, and it gives her occupation, what she has done before she's married, and sort of her personality. And there are places where probably these things aren't going to work out, so keep that in mind. That's just a little secret I'm telling you.
Thank you.
You play an important role in your husband's call. You can discuss all of the situations, advantages and disadvantages in the call, but it is best that you do not influence him into making his decisions. This should be between him and his God. He needs your prayers, and he will certainly consider your position in making his decision, his final decision. His family naturally is considered in these things, but first of all, it's between him and his God. Should your husband be an assistant pastor in a parish, then you will have to learn to share your position or your station, that you and the assistant's wife or whatever, whichever position you're in, and also the husband. We had a beautiful association and relationship with our associates, and it worked well. And professional ethics need to be practiced here by both pastors and by both parties, and you would never belittle your husband nor his assistant or the bishop with whom he is working in public. This is something that we just don't do, because the people respect and need to keep that respect for the man who is serving them. Good communications will do a lot to keep peace and harmony in this relationship also. Being a pastor's wife is a high calling and an honor. There are many joys and rewarding experiences that the two of you can share. God is your partner, and you are very much aware of this every day of your life. How can you support your husband in all areas of his calling, pray for him, and show him your love and cooperation? Of all people, you can help him the most by being pleasant, kind, never nagging, keeping a clean home, and just being you. After all, he fell in love with you, and he wanted you to share this life with him. My years spent as a pastor's wife have been the greatest, and I thank the Lord that he has allowed me to be a helpmate to a man who is thoroughly dedicated in his calling. And I pray that God would bless every one of you with love and dedication for work in his kingdom. Thank you.
Is there anything to add from our panel? Any questions from our audience? From Miss? Yes, Debbie.
I was just wondering if you can ever get too involved within a church with a lady or somebody, even a man, object to having pastors women so involved.
Well, every situation is different. I mean, every parish is different. There are different types of people and different localities, and the things that they've been, that have been tradition there, I would say. But I don't think you can become too involved. You have to know for yourself how much you can do. I would say pick certain things, especially if you're just starting, you have a family at home. You're going to have to make some choices. But I thought I was quite active. Ruth McGabe was with us for 12 years. And there were a lot of things that I didn't attend. I attended PTA until our children were gone. And still, places like this are good. You at least know all the parents of the children that are in school. And it's good for you to know these people, because as you're parish grows, you're going to lose contact with some of these people. You're not going to know everybody, but it's a good way of getting acquainted and at least show up for some of these things.
I've been asked, they are recording this session we're having, and if you would try to either speak up loudly or use a microphone, because they want to hear our questions as well as the answers. I forgot to say that when Debbie gave her question. So would you speak up or use the mic?
You should have said that after I talked. Okay, you made a statement toward the end that sounded so easy, and you know that just comes forth. You said all you have to do is support him and be happy and have a clean house and these different things. And it, you know, when you said it, it sounded so easy. I've been a DCE's wife, and I know at times it's very difficult to be happy to your husband. And when he goes out of the house each evening, you know, it just keeps going. And sometimes you need something coming in so that you can keep being happy. I know I've let him down many times because I wasn't happy. Like you said, that's all you have to do. And when you're not happy, I know it makes him stay miserable and he can't do his job. But where does it come from? Who can? That's my question.
Well, I think there your husband can help you too. I think that you need him as much as he needs you. And I think preachers' wives do a lot of praying. I know I did.
Still do.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Jerry?
I might be a little bit ahead of myself. I hope I'm going to be saying some of our questions and some of the problems in the closing comments. But to give yourself strength and a source of renewal, you must turn to Christ, who will strengthen you and who will give you the answers. and I hope we can elaborate on that a little later. But that's a very good question. And there are congregations that you will go to that you will not be the first lady, and where the pastor is not respected. There are congregations that are falling apart, congregations that are in big trouble, that have perhaps had bad examples in the past or poor ministry in the past. And when you get there, you're going to have to be prepared for this kind of a situation. And again, your source of strength is Christ. And your love and your devotion and your behavior will come from that. So I think Mrs. Weber is absolutely right. It is a beautiful experience. And I suppose, by and large, you're going to be in congregations like that. But be prepared, because some are not. And also, you are young. And I like to include myself in this category, too. I think when you're young, and your men are young, the respect does not come automatically either. They kind of look at this young guy as a little inexperienced, and what does he know? And his wife, you know, pretty similar to that. So that might be another thing you might encounter. Again, going back to Christ and your strength. So I hope to elaborate on that a little bit.
Yes, thanks.
How do you handle the situation where if a parishioner tries to get to your husband through you, you know, they don't really want to talk to the pastor, but they want him to know certain things. And if this does happen, how much of it do you pass on to just take in and, you know, and possibly gossip or hearsay?
Well, these things have happened to me, and naturally I will tell my husband that this is this lady or whoever has talked to me about this, and if the opportunity arises, he can just sort of, you know, mention it, or if the occasion comes up that he can counsel with them. But I certainly stress that he is there to hear their problems, and would they please talk to him, because he can certainly give them better answers than I can. And they have to gain the confidence of this man first. He, you know, after you get to a place, people aren't going to swarm there, because they just don't know you. They have to feel you out first and become acquainted with you. But generally, they have confidence in their pastor, and I would encourage them to talk to the man rather than to tell me all of their problems. That's what he's there for, and they have to bring their troubles to him and to the Lord, of course.
Judy, you had a question.
No, I was just going to reply to Sig. Don't let yourself get caught as the middle person, because you can tell your husband and he might tell you, and in between times, like playing the telephone game. And by the time the message gets through, it's going to be all jumbled anyway. The best way is just to say, fine, if you have a concern, speak to the person you're concerned about. And that's the best way to handle that.
Sue, do you have a question?
I was wondering, is this also going something that may be of a critical nature toward him? You know, like a lot of our husbands are very young, and they may not preach as well as the pastor did before, and they might be saying things, you know, about this, like, oh, I wish that he came across a little better, or, you know, something like that. What do you think?
Well, I don't think they would come and tell you that in the first place.
I've encountered in Gilbert Church.
Have you?
Yes, and what I did was, I thought about it and prayed about it a couple of days, and then I tried to very tactfully say, it was something that was like not speaking loud enough and distinctly enough, and kind of brought it out, not that it had come from another person in the conversation, but that was something I had noticed and tried to, but I really had to be awfully careful.
Yes.
He was so sensitive.
Yeah. And still they appreciate it. I'm sure they do.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
situation like with my husband Spielberg, he considers me his best critic, and so whatever I can tell him is improvement, he'll take it, because he knows I'm probably the pickiest, and he'll listen to him probably the closest, so he always considers me his best critic.
I've come up with the same thing in field working, where people came up and told me, "Boy, your sermon was wonderful," as if I had written it. Maybe, but I didn't do that.
But isn't it wonderful to be able to relay this to your husband?
Yeah, it's nice. At the same time, I would like to see these people tell him. It makes more of an impression on him when that parishioner comes up and says, "That was wonderful," rather than I say, "Well, I heard some people, say it was good." He likes to hear it too.
I'd like to speak a little bit more about the counseling that the pastor does and betraying confidences. So I guess I'm particularly touchy about it because I was in a congregation once where the pastor told his wife everything, and it was like telegraph or telephone. He told one set of friends in the congregation, and it was spread like wildfire. And of course, it got all distorted, and it caused unbelievable problems. And I'm wondering, is this professional ethics for a pastor to discuss these things with his wife? Do pastors normally do this? And could you elaborate more on advice about this kind of thing?
Well, of course, your husband should know what he can tell you and what should be left unsaid. And I don't think I was ever one to pass on any confidences of any kind. And I have seen parishes, too, where they say it went in the front door and out the back faster than it came in the front. And I learned from this that I was never, ever going to, become involved in gossip. And a good many a time, I was asked pertinent questions. And I blushed and said, "I don't know," but they knew that I knew, and I just was not about to pass on any information. Counseling is a serious job for your husband, and sometimes he does have to discuss this with someone, and he will naturally choose you. But I'm sure I don't know everything that my husband ever counseled with or with whom or anything.
My husband tells me everything. There's a thought that goes through his head that he doesn't tell me or we talk about. So I know that we'll be discussing these things, and it rather scares me to think that I might possibly betray somebody.
You will just have to be careful, and it's going to take practice. And the longer you're in this, the easier it's going to be, and the more you're going to enjoy doing things together with your husband. But it's always best to be quiet and let the other person do the talking. And of course, there's your Lord. You can talk and pray and talk to him, and it's helpful.
Anybody else have a question? I haven't looked over on this side. I would like to have one of the ladies discuss ordination and installation. Many of us are going to be going through this. Whether there is a reception planned by the family, your family, by the church, and if you have these things in two different places, can you give us some light on ordination and installation? Any of you? Maybe just from your own experience, maybe that will help us.
I don't want to do all the talking here, but since my husband was the district president, he preached for a good many an ordination and installation, and it was usually the parish that put on the reception, and you were the guest of honor and your families, and they usually had either a light lunch or a dinner, or they had things planned.
Usually if your ordination is in your home congregation, though, separate from the installation, then isn't it usually up to the family to have a reception, if you want a reception for them? Now, we've had ordinations of students of our congregation, and then the family usually either had a reception in the church basement or privately someplace else. If it's if it's the installation, that usually is up to the congregation, and they almost always have something for it.
And I think also if the one to be ordained is a product of that congregation, the congregation often does this for him. It's a special honor if he's the son of the congregation. But our son-in-law was ordained at our church, and his mother planned the entire reception, and our ladies gladly were there mm-hmm. to serve and to welcome the people. But an installation is like Joan said, that's what I've experienced. That's the congregation's honor for you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions, ladies, even on this topic? Well, fine. All right, then we'll go on to the next topic, which has to do with preacher's kids. And we either all have some or will have some, so this should be a very good topic. Mrs. DeBerkey?
I was reading the article that Sue had written in the Spectrum. I think you wrote it, didn't you? Mm-hmm. And she used the term veterans and about the people who were on the panel, and it made me feel very old until I look out here and see all of your young faces, and I realize we are very old. But and then it also implies experience, and I guess we have experience, but we certainly don't have all the answers. I think it's something that everyone has to experience for yourself, and the most we can do is give you our opinions and some experiences from our life, but everyone has a different congregation. You have a different husband, you have different children, and it's really very hard to ever give anyone the answers. But with that, I'll proceed to preacher's kids. It reminds me of a note my daughter had written in her yearbook from high school last year. It said, "I'd rather listen to the PK any day than the P." And I won't comment any more on that. I have two children in high school, and it's hard to remember sometimes what it was like when they were all preschoolers, but they were all preschoolers at one time. And you're going to hear an awful lot of advice and stories about the problems that are involved with PKs, and I guess the best advice I can give you is to ignore most of those stories, because it's true you're going to have to work very hard to raise preacher's kids, but every mother has to work hard to raise children today. It's not an easy job, but it's a wonderful job, and I really don't think you have a lot of different problems raising your children as preacher's kids than any other parent does. And I guess the one thing we really hope that we would never give our children the impression that they were different, or that they were in a fishbowl, or that they had different things to live up to, because they were just kids like everyone else's kids, and we didn't want them to have any special privileges or any special problems. They were supposed to live their lives because they were God's children, not because they were preacher's kids. And I hope we never gave them the idea that you do this or you don't do this because your dad is a preacher, but you do something because you're God's children, just as every other Christian should be doing the very same thing. When we first went into the ministry, we were in a very small, rural parish with mostly retired people, and there had only been old pastors there for a long time and no little children, and we were there 5 years before we had any family. Our children are all adopted. So we were there 5 years, and all of these people were waiting for us to have children, and when we finally adopted our first daughter, they just sort of swallowed her up. And I guess because I'd waited so long for a baby and so desperately for a baby, I was very resentful of this. And I look back on that now and I realize how wrong I was. It just seemed like everyone in the congregation was giving me advice on everything from when to burp the baby, and she happened to be a baby who did nothing but cry, and I guess I was upset, and I remember it as being a very bad time because I really didn't let the congregation love that little girl. I just felt I had read all the books, I knew exactly what to do, I knew all the answers, and they wanted to help so badly, and they wanted to, you know, give me advice and spoil her, and I didn't allow them to do that. And I think if I could go back and do that over again, I would let the congregation have a chance to really love our children, and I guess I'd like to advise you to do that too. You are a special family to them, And I don't think your children are going to get spoiled by a lot of attention, if it's done in the right way. And I think we should make, if they want to babysit with your children, I didn't even want them to do this. I just felt I wanted full care of that little girl. So I hope none of you make that same mistake. And then I think it's important for us to let our children learn to love the congregation and learn to know the members. I think it'll be a whole lot easier if Dad has to spend all Christmas Day at the hospital, if they know that he's with this little old Grandma Goodrich, that they know and have spent some time with her and eaten her cookies. And maybe instead of grumbling when the picnic is called off, they'll understand this is the man down the street who had a heart attack and Dad has to be in the hospital. They can get to know your members, your old people and your young ones, and I think maybe they'll understand a little better when Dad is gone so much, because this is going to happen. I think it's important that they learn that these are important people to me. I belong to them and they belong to me. It's rather than just sort of shutting them away into a life of their own. My husband used to take our children with him on shut-in calls occasionally, never three at once, because no shut-in could take that. But one at a time, and they got to know the old people, and it was a real thrill for the people to see them and to have a little child around once again. And it had an added bonus. It gave my husband a chance to maybe spend a few hours alone with the children. While he went, especially in an area like that where you drove many miles to hospitals, it gave him the opportunity to be with that child individually. I would never try to convince you that it's always going to be easy, because it isn't. When you've planned your Thanksgiving dinner for 12 o'clock and your husband gets home at 6, and holidays are always the worst, it seems like more people are sick, more people have problems, more people need a pastor over the holiday season than any other time. And it's not going to be easy on Sunday morning when you're struggling with three preschoolers or to try to get them ready for church, when you see all the other husbands and wives who can sit together in church and share this, and you're struggling with them alone. But I think there again is a chance to make use of the members in your congregation. And most of them, if you're at all open to them, they'll be glad to help you. I remember when we moved here, and I did have three little children, three preschoolers, and one of our members came up and said, "You can't handle them all. I'm going to take one." And she did, every Sunday. And I think by this time I had learned I couldn't do it all myself, and I didn't know all the answers. And I was glad to have that help. So I think if you learn to be accepting and understanding and accept your congregation members, it'll just help your load so much more. Another thing, one of you mentioned, be flexible, learn to bend, and I just really had to say amen to that. Your schedule isn't always going to go as planned. Your husband's not going to come home at 5 o'clock every night for supper. He's not going to be there at noon every Sunday. I guess one of the things, this is a very minor thing, but I guess one of the things we've started doing is we don't wait anymore for meals. It's very hard for little children or even teenagers when you plan your supper and they have a lot of other things they want to do to have to sit around a couple hours and wait. For us, it's been so much easier just to eat. My husband almost always goes to the hospitals on Sunday noons before he comes home. He almost always has someone he feels he'd rather go and see before he came home for the day. And it just works so much better for us to go ahead and eat. Then the children can each go about doing whatever they want to do, and when he comes home, he can have a quiet meal. I know that sounds like you really haven't very much family togetherness, but it's really not a good time to have a lot of togetherness if everyone is at each other's throats because dinner is 3 hours late and my friends have been waiting for me for 3 hours. So sometimes those little things really can give you a more relaxed family life. It's going to be very hard to get used to your husband being gone all the time, as Mrs. Weber said, particularly when he's in a larger church. There is always something to do. It's very hard to find time to do anything as a family. And another thing that has really worked for us is to really plan times together and plan things to do when your husband is gone too. Rather than grumbling or feeling sorry for yourself that you're alone all the time and you have to take care of your children alone all the time, plan things. Go to the park. Get to know your neighbors. You'd be surprised how many neighbors are alone too and have little children at home and are sitting home alone and would be happy to have someone else to do it with. You're really not the only one in this position. So plan things to do during the day when he's not home, or plan things in the evening, and you'd be surprised how much easier it is not to sit around and feel sorry for yourself. And there are going to be times when all of your children have the flu and the baby is teething, and as you said, it's not always going to be easy, but it is temporary. And in a few years, your children will be older, and life is going to get a little bit easier. Sometimes maybe it's important to spend a little of the money that you really are saving for drapes and get a babysitter and go shopping, or get a babysitter and go with your husband. Even though you love your children, I don't think you need to feel that you're a bad mother because you need to get away from them once in a while. And then I really think it's important to plan to do things with your husband and your children as a family. My husband, and I'm sure all of yours will be that way too if they're good pastors, and I'm sure they will be, their work is never done. There's always someone who needs calling on, there's always someone who needs counseling, there's always a delinquent, there's always someone sick, there's always work to be done. And if he's at all dedicated to his work, he's always going to be thinking about that unless you really plan an evening together. We have to sit down probably and say, okay, next Friday, we're going to do something next Friday. We're going to go bowling, because you don't do that with little children. It doesn't have to be something big or expensive or exciting. Maybe next Friday we're going to sit down, we're going to make pizza with the children, or we're going to play a game together. And it probably sounds silly to you right now that this is necessary, but it is necessary, because otherwise the year goes by and you've really spent very little time together. So at least for us, that's the answer. And as our children are older now and teenagers, we'll plan to go out. We'll go to, even if it's to Bonanza or McDonald's, but as your children become older, they have so many things of their own, and unless you really set aside time to do something as a family, you just don't have much time to do it. And it's important that your husband gets to spend some individual time with each of your children too, particularly as they get older, so that one day he maybe decides, I'm going to take just my daughter out to lunch, or I'm going to just take my son to the Central Hardware where they love to go. One of the questions that the committee had suggested we discuss was problem teenagers. We hope, of course, none of this doesn't happen to you, but the odds are that it will happen to some of you. You will have some problem teenagers. I really feel that if you've had a good relationship with your congregation and you've been open and warm to them, the fact that you have a child who might be a problem is not something that you need to be embarrassed about or ashamed of, or I have to take a call because my congregation knows my daughter is pregnant. I think this is something that if you are all Christians working together for the same purpose. Most of these people who've raised children know that what this is like, or what it's like to have problems, and you would be surprised how much help and consolation you can get from your congregation when you do have a teenager with a problem. You need their prayers, and I think perhaps if you go to them and ask them for their prayers and ask them for their help and their comfort, just as you want to help them when they have problems, you want them to come to you. I think by going to them and asking them for their help, rather than pretending that nothing is wrong or that your children are perfect, I think you'll find that it works out much better. When I was a teacher, before I had any children, it was so easy to know exactly where all the parents were doing things wrong. You could sit in the classroom and know exactly why every child had a problem by pointing to his parents. But after you've raised your own children, you realize how little you knew, and I guess you can really sympathize with parents now when Johnny can't read, because you know what it isn't always his parents' fault. Maybe they've done everything they can, and it's that way with the ministry too. I think maybe sometimes when the congregation realizes our pastor has a son that he's struggling with, that he has a problem with too, or he has a son that he's having difficulty getting him to attend church, you can have a real sharing and understanding and that you've never had before. And it isn't always going to be great in the parsonage. You might have children who don't want to attend church or who refuse to go to youth meetings, But you'll remember then the times you said, if they were really Christians, they would, their children would do this and they'd do that, and you realize that it just isn't always true. But I think you need to be open and sharing with them, and you will receive a lot of help. In closing, I'm sure all of you have heard this statement, but it's been a comfort to me many times, that it's quality, not quantity of time that counts. And so even though your husband is not going to be home a lot, he's not going to spend a lot of time with your children, many other dads don't either, many fathers who are home every night of the week, sitting in front of the television or doing nothing with their children, this is not the answer either. And I really feel if the time spent together is good, if it's worthwhile, if it's loving, it isn't the amount of time you do things together or spend together nearly as much as the quality of time. An hour of something special is worth far more than a whole week together if it isn't really together, even though you're in the same house. So I certainly would tell you girls that it's worth it, it's worth the time you're alone, it's worth the struggle.
Okay. Any other discussion from the panel? Yes, Lita.
I just wanted to mention that I wanted to supplement something that Mrs. DeBerge said. Our little girl Tammy was born in March of our first year of vicarage, and we had no family out there. We had no one, no real close friends or anything like that, except in the congregation. And I was kind of scared about the responsibilities and everything. Well, I was just really pleased afterward when Tammy was born. The congregation was so loving and they kind of adopted Tammy. She became part of them, and it was a terrific relationship that Tammy had with the congregation and the congregation with Tammy. And we always had built-in babysitters, whether it was the children from the youth group or parents, or people were just so willing to help and just, you know, in any way possible. So.
I'd like to ask a question of the field workers who have families. If they experience already the extra love and that a congregation gives to their children, I think they have it. I hope ours at Timothy realize that how much the members look on their families as special. And I wonder if the wives sense this.
Go ahead.
Is there something, we're just new at our Fieldwork Church, and it seems like there's really no contact between, like, myself and the congregation. We have never been introduced. Now, I don't know if there's something we are supposed to do, you know, to meet people. I go to church and Bible class, and people say hi. But beyond that, it's difficult to feel part of the congregation. Now, is that just because we came in mid-year, or...
I would say that it's just individual congregations that are that way, because we weren't introduced or anything, and we came in summer already, and there wasn't any difference.
I think maybe someone needs to remind the pastor sometimes of his duties in this. They get so busy they forget. And maybe we all need to be reminded that we need to go out of our way to make sure our congregation gets to know our field workers and that they are introduced. It is easy to overlook some of those things.
Do we have any? Yes.
This is kind of a response to your first question. I have a little girl who's almost three, and I have a teacher at the school where my husband's a field worker, but I think I've gotten more people through her. Because after church, you know, she may be up there picking her nose during the Christmas program, but everybody in the church will say something to me about it afterwards, you know, how cute she looked up there, not staying apart with things. But I don't believe that's really helped. I can just kind of stand outside after church and somebody will come up and talk to me about her, and it's open more doors, I think, that way. And I know she's been very much adopted. It is helping me.
I had a friend in college who was a PK. She'd been the daughter of an Episcopal minister. And she told me once that the thing that she had resented the most was that the kids in her family had been looked on as the automatic unpaid babysitters for the congregation, especially whenever there was trouble in a family in the congregation and dad would be out, you know, ministering to the parents, just drag the kid away from their homework and you go babysit for those kids for 5 or 6 hours. Now, obviously, that's something that we as parents have a lot of control over, but I was wondering if any of you ladies have ever, you know, run into a congregation where that was expected of your children or, you know, called upon.
I certainly haven't.
Yes, go ahead.
I have another comment or question sort of in that same line. My dad, so I've been a teacher, and I willingly accept the fact that little children, toddlers, and preschoolers are readily accepted in a congregation. But have any of you experienced that in your family where you're moving when the child is, you know, like 10, 11, 12, something, moving to a new congregation? And then I don't think it's quite, the congregations aren't quite as receptive to the pastor's kid or the teacher's kid in that situation. And also, do you think that that idea is changing? Do you think that the pastor's family is being watched as much as it used to be?
In answer to your last question, I don't think they're being watched as much. I guess I feel there's such a difference in places. In a place like St. Louis, there are so many PKs. I think even in our grade school, there are 3, 4, and 5 PKs in each class. They're just not watched. When I grew up, I was not a PK, and I remember how much the preacher's kids were on display. It was a small town. There were no other ones around. And here, they simply, my children are at Lutheran High, and it's such a common thing. So I don't really know if it would be that way in a small town again, because I've lived here since my children have been teenagers.
We have. Yes, go ahead.
Well, we lived in St. Louis. I had a daughter of 12. We came here, she was 10 and a half, and our fieldwork church has never been very helpful at all as far as our children. Our children are now 8 and 12, and they really had a hard time adjusting. And they're going to a Lutheran school, and it's took about a year and a half for the only one to be accepted even in the Lutheran school. It's been really hard. I think that's the problem that we have with older people coming in the cemetery. We have a lot of older men coming with older children. Another problem that we're going to have to face too.
Yvonne, did you want to make a comment?
Well, I would just agree with Joan. I don't think that your children are watched in a bad sense, because I always think that they have a special blessing because the people really love them, and they're as proud of them, I think, as they are the wife or even their pastor. And I think they might expect a little extra from them, but I think the children ought to know that too, that they have a special place in a congregation and they ought to put forth a little bit of effort.
Mabel, you have a question.
I was just going to say, we have been 20 years in Lutheran education in Christian schools in 3 congregations. And the 3 congregations were all beautiful, beautiful experiences for us, but every one was unique. Our little children, our toddlers, our babies aren't just the idols of our people. But things do change as our children get older. My children are 7, 8, and 13. We're in a fieldwork church and we're only going to be here 1 year. I wonder if sometimes our fieldwork churches know the temporariness of our stay. We are not going to be permanent. Our 2 little children have, you know, they still are losing teeth and doing cute things, saying nice things, getting around. But our 13-year-old has had a struggle. You know, she hasn't had people invite her to their home. Both the little ones have been invited out. I would not accuse or point a finger at the congregation, but I think it's something that we all face, and it just gets different as your family gets older. But this thing of flexibility that the ladies have said, I really appreciate hearing that, because it's part of our life.
I don't think the problems with children in school, though, are because you're a preacher or a teacher. That would be the problem with any child that age. It's not an easy age to move for children. But I think if your husband were a lawyer or a doctor, an Indian chief, the problems would be identical. You know.
Debbie?
I thought that no matter who you are, if you're an engineer or your husband's an engineer, I think they're all going to have problems changing. But then, follow that question, I'm a PK myself, although I like to consider myself a teal theological offspring, you know. I heard that one time that made me really proud to be a PK, you know, because I had, you know, that little cute thing. But I was wondering, like, I, as the older one in my family, never had any problems. I never was put up, you know, you're the best kid, you're supposed to be perfect, you know, all this and that. But my other brother and sister have had a little bit of stuff, maybe in high school, I don't know where it was. I was just wondering if you feel maybe with your children, if you prepare them for this, or do you think it's better not to say anything at all, if they might be anticipating that people might treat them a little different? I was wondering if you just say nothing or prepare them. My mom didn't prepare me, but I didn't.
I guess I wouldn't feel I would need to prepare my children. Sometimes by preparing ahead of time, they get the feeling that's just my opinion. I just would think as if anything came up, then we could talk about it. But rather than to, ahead of time, get them prepared for a situation that might never occur. You've all had teenagers. Maybe you feel differently about that.
Well, I feel that when mine were they're teenagers now, they have less of a problem than when they were smaller. When you get to 6 and 7 and maybe even 5, that extra kiss or pat or hug is sometimes not what they want. That's when I would explain that they are really blessed extra because God has given them a big family, a real big family. But when they're teenagers, I think they're accepted so well nowadays. You don't have the restrictions of, my husband's a PK. You don't do this because, you know, you are in this family, you know, because years ago there were a lot of no-nos. But today the world is different, and you have more liberties, or the teenagers do.
Any other questions? Yes, Judy.
I was just going to make a comment. We have 3 what we consider congregation babies. They were born in congregations we were serving. And living so far away from any of our immediate family, we readily accepted any help and any grandparents that might want to come in and adopt the kids, this type of thing, because it gave our children a feeling of family also. Something that we couldn't say that this is your grandmother and grandfather, but they got to calling people grandma and grandpa in congregation. And this way they know too that a family is not just the immediate group living in this particular home, that it's more than that. So that was kind of nice.
Any other questions? Well, then we're going to take a break. Mm-hmm. Oh, excuse me.
Yes, go ahead.
I just had one thought. All of us have children and they're all God's children. We all remember that we're preparing our children to behave as God's children, whether they're daddies or preachers or doctors or whatever. So they're going to behave right if they're living for God and not for their daddy or their mother or the congregation or whatever.
That's a very good point to end on, I believe. You probably all want to stand up, and I'd like to sit down. So before we break, I want to make note of Elaine Sestak has an embroidery, ecclesiastical embroidery display. We have a very large book display. You may purchase some books, and if you haven't brought your money, you may order some books if you wish. This has to do with our role as a pastor's wife. And there is also some donuts and coffee for those of you who are in need of refreshments. So break.